This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A massive heat wave stretches across Asia from the Middle East to Indochina. India's heat waves are no ordinary phenomenon. This spring, some Indian temperatures soared to nearly 50 degrees C around the country, over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. March was the hottest in 122 years, and the heat wave hit much earlier than usual. How will Indian cities prepare to survive climate change? What is the future for 1.5 billion people there? We have contacted an internationally connected climate scientist. Dr. Manal Pathak is associate professor at Ahmedabad University in a city of more than 8 million people. In addition to her contributions to IPCC reports, Manal Pathak specializes in urban adaptation. From Ahmedabad, Manal Pathak, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about your weather lately. How are people in your city coping?
It's really the middle of summer. I don't think we are doing any better than what we were last year. Summers are getting progressively worse. And while we have a few climate initiatives now, I don't think they're enough. And if a lot of people may be aware that India is also going through a major election, our national elections are underway in most of the country. And people are standing in long queues to vote. It was scheduled in my city yesterday, so I went to vote and I tried to get in early, so 8 a.m. But it was extremely uncomfortable. It was hot. I didn't check the temperature, but it might be around maybe between 36 and 38 degrees Celsius, and it was a bit humid. And these were like held in cramped voting centers. There were a lot of people there. I saw a lot of senior citizens there, and heat with humidity, and we were all perspiring, and I just didn't feel very well at the end of the day. And you're talking to someone who is already a privileged citizen, right? So I have an air-conditioned home, an air-conditioned office. I also own a car. But there's a whole lot of people in the country, in cities, who lack basic facilities. Some of them don't even have properly ventilated housing. They don't have fans to cool themselves. And many of these people actually have to work outdoors. So I would say it doesn't look good in summary. It's quite depressing, actually, to be honest.
And with oppressive heat becoming more common across India, has climate change emerged as an election issue?
So, well, the good news is that climate is a lot more in conversation, in mainstream conversation than it used to be. For example, climate or environment didn't really feature prominently in past election manifestos. If you look at elections a decade ago, there was no conversation around environment. And now people do realize that this is a reality. It's affecting them. And a lot of people care and are concerned. So it's appeared if you look at the major parties, then you can see climate appearing in the manifestos now, which is great. So there's promises around energy independence, there's promises around scaling up renewable energy, even technology is mentioned, and including rooftop solar and funding for climate initiatives. But I don't think it's like a make or break thing. I don't think people are voting for these parties on the basis of their climate promises, partly because there is still limited awareness. So there is awareness that climate change is happening, but there isn't really, I don't think people are making that explicit connection between actions and what we're facing. So kind of disconnected. And I wouldn't say this is true for India. I think it's true for a lot of the world, where people see that they're suffering, but they somehow, when it comes to taking action, kind of disengage from that conversation. And the other thing, coming back to your question, was that yes, it's in the manifestos, but then it's sort of a bit vague still. So they're like big promises, but not really specificity regarding targets, for example, or when certain initiatives will be implemented. So on paper, these look good, but I would have liked to see a little more.
Well, all of that could be said for Canada, the United States, and many countries, as you say. So broadly, what is the Modi government's position on climate change?
So on the one hand, I would appreciate the government for taking really ambitious actions on renewable energy, for example. That's like really a big success story, right? We've outpaced our solar targets. We're doing well on wind and other renewable energy initiatives. And there's a very interesting program. I don't know if you're aware. It's called Mission Life, and it was announced by the Prime Minister a couple of years ago at the climate meeting, COP. And this is about making lifestyle changes for sustainability. And I thought it was a great idea, although we still have to, like I said, put some teeth on it. So what does it mean, and how do we tell people to make these lifestyle changes? So there has been progressively, initiatives by the Indian government on taking action. But then on the other hand, I feel the pace is not enough, particularly if you look at where we need to be in terms of global mitigation ambition. India is a big country, and while the per capita emissions are quite low because we are so many people, India's decisions or the pace of it will make a big difference to global climate change, both in the near future, but definitely long-term ambition as well. So I feel we probably need to do more. But Modi's stand is very clear that historically India hasn't contributed as much as some of the Western countries, particularly US and EU. And therefore, the onus is really on these countries to provide the finance and to take bolder steps, because a lot of India still needs room to develop and grow. So I think on one hand, the government says, yes, we need to do more on renewable energy. But on the other hand, the government feels that we're doing enough. And any more ambition will lead to like much higher costs, and to some extent might also compromise near-term development.
I heard India may have reduced heat deaths during extreme events. Following mass heat deaths just a few years ago, governments implemented emergency planning for heat waves. Is that true? And what actions have been taken?
That is true, and that's another one of our successful programs. So I think, and I'm not very sure, but it did start in my city of Ahmedabad, where Ahmedabad's heat action plan was among South Asia's first for a city. And it was a really great plan because it brought together government, the private sector, and US's NRDC. I think it's called National Resources Defense Council. I believe they're an energy organization as well. So anyway, these stakeholders came together and produced this heat action plan, which was mostly focused on early warning. So telling people when there is a heat wave to take shelter, to step out, not to step out during the peak hours in the afternoon. It had initiatives like building capacity of the health workers. And then that was such a big success, in the sense that the plan rolled out almost immediately in that year. In a couple of years, we had evidence that this had actually reduced heat deaths. More people were availing of these emergency services, and you could see posters around the city, with these animations and stuff, telling people to cover themselves and take shelter, etc. And then this was because of its success. It was replicated in a number of states and cities. So I think there are at least 23 states now in India which have these heat action plans. And while some of them are just focusing on early warning, some others are a little more ambitious, and they talk about long-term measures also, including tree planting and reducing the overall heat in the city. So that's the good side of the story. The sort of slightly more problematic side is that we need to do a lot more. We need to raise ambition, because these heat action plans are still standalone. They're not really mainstreamed into city development plans. So on the one hand, we're trying to tell people, okay, protect yourselves from heat. The city governments are doing what they can. But then on the other hand, the urban development is going on in business as usual. So we still have all these concrete buildings and a lot of concrete on the roads and sidewalks. And so that's also increasing the heat in cities. So I feel like we really need to sort of mainstream heat into our development process, which is not yet happening.
Is it possible to know how many people in rural India are dying due to extreme heat?
I don't think it's very easy to know that, but one of the reasons is data issues that that we really need to record deaths more systematically. And in India, healthcare is divided between public and private healthcare systems. And therefore, we don't have a very solid database on health, particularly on mortality and the causes for mortality. So there are some studies which have attributed, for example, daytime temperatures with deaths on that day. But I think the short answer to your question is no, it's really difficult at the moment.
Do Indian media report the role of climate change and emissions in stories during these heat waves?
The Indian media reports heat, the changing climate, the impacts, the future impacts, but I don't think we are relating it to emissions that explicitly in the media, which is a problem. We're not doing that. But I wanted to go back to your previous question on rural India. And I wanted to say that, not that I have data, but I feel rural India is still in many ways more sustainable. So they have lower density, lower concrete, and more shaded areas. And people still live a traditional way of life. And I feel like urban India, particularly all these migrant workers, they come to these cities to work and they are a lot more exposed because they're working in the heat. Like all these construction workers, they are outdoors like 8 hours, 10 hours a day. And many of them may be rushed to emergency wards in hospitals. And really, we don't have a good idea of how many of them are exposed.
This year, you co-authored a helpful paper on a just transition away from coal. As coal declines, some places will suffer more than others. But no transition away from coal is really happening in India, as far as I can tell. In August 2023, at a lecture, the Deputy Director General of the Ministry of Coal, Santosh Agarwal, said, "As far as India is concerned, transition away from coal is not happening in the near future," end quote. The government intends actually to increase coal burning in the near term. Manal, how do you see this conflict between climate needs and economic planning?
So that's a very complex question. Let me try to unpack it a bit. So let me give you two or three lines of argument for and against. So, I mean, one of the arguments that the Indian government is making, like I mentioned before on this call, is that if you look at contributions of countries, then India probably contributed like 4% to historical emissions. So if you look at emissions between 1850 to let's say 2019, India's contribution was 4% compared to like 20%, I think, for the United States, or around that number for EU and China. India's argument is that the bulk of the responsibility for action rests with the countries which have contributed more and have higher means to act. Having said that, I know that the coal jobs in India are not great jobs. If you go to the mines and ask the coal worker, "Do you want your son to do this?" He would, I'm sure, say no. He has actually in one of the interviews we did. So we do want to move away from coal, but you see, it's very difficult because coal brings a lot of revenue to state governments and district governments. So there's the coal cess, there's a mineral fund, and there's a bunch of taxes that coal companies pay. And coal also drives a lot of freight in the country. So it also gives a revenue to Indian railways. So if you move away immediately from coal, then you lose a lot of revenue. And that's really not very easy. The good news is that renewables are really becoming cost effective. You know that globally, the price of solar has dropped by 85%. I mean, whether the government says it or not, we're already moving away from coal. The investments in new coal plants is difficult, but then how else do you meet the power demand for such a large country? So the challenge really is that we want energy security, and we really don't have until solar and wind and battery storage become so cost effective that we can have a stable grid away from coal. But in the near term, I don't see how we can just stop coal in the next decade or so. But I'm still hopeful. As a scientist, I'm looking at development in technology, at energy trading, and if dispatchable energy becomes a reality, then I don't think we need to depend on the coal plants that much. And just one last point on your question is that a lot of other countries, for example, the UK, was also reopening coal plants. And I know the U.S. is investing heavily in shale gas. So there's also all these other things in the world. So climate is about international cooperation. So it's not about one country or the other. It's about all countries raising ambition at the same time and going beyond national interest to say, yes, we will probably lose jobs in the short run, but we're going to have to all work together to see how we can help those communities and take action. And so I feel like the whataboutism is really coming in the way of collective climate action. And every time I go to these international climate meetings, I hear, what about China? What about India? And then if I am in the domestic setting, I hear, what about the US? And then that's really not the way we are going to be able to get where we want to go.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Aminal Pathak for the University of Ahmedabad, India.
All right, you also co-authored the 2022 paper, Mitigation Co-Benefits of Climate Change Adaptation, a case study analysis of 8 cities. And one of the cities studied was Surat, India, with over 5 million people. Tell us about Surat and climate planning.
So Surat is among the early movers. It's an industrial city and also growing very fast. But the Rockefeller Foundation funded like 100 Indian cities, 100 global cities a decade ago. And Surat was selected among the 3 Indian cities. So they had initial support to build a resilience strategy for Surat. And I think that plan looks really good. And Surat therefore was able to start early on. And they have taken measures, for example, to reduce flooding. So Surat has this river running through. And they have a flood warning system. So it's quite an interesting case study. And I feel like if many of these cities get the support, they like Surat, the level of ambition would be higher. So I don't know how familiar the listeners are with the Indian system, but like cities don't have resources really or capacity. So it's very, very different. If you go to a small and medium sized city, like say a little smaller than Surat, there would probably be a couple of people just running the show, and they have to manage the solid waste and the water and just provide housing for all the new people who come in and roads and all the day-to-day development necessities or services. And therefore, climate doesn't often assume a priority. So if you want cities to take actions, then you have to enable them with finance, with capacity, you know. I mean, I take all these fancy IPCC charts. Sometimes I get like responses from policymakers saying, I'm sorry, I don't understand. Explain this graph to me. And this may be true for a lot of other worlds. It's not just India, but you look at Latin American cities or African cities, for example. There's really a capacity issue there. We need a lot more technical people in these cities to be able to understand what actions are relevant for their cities, what might work and what kind of support they need, and often even how to leverage that support. So if I'm a city, let's say of 1 million, which is, by the way, small in the Indian context, I don't know where to get the money from. I don't know. There's all this climate finance talk that I'm hearing internationally, but I really don't have a way to get it to my city. And if I do, then I don't know which action should I take that will give me the highest return on climate or development. So our paper really was about how do you take development as a framing for climate? Are there actions, for example, that improve people's mobility and that can also reduce emissions? Because for a lot of developing countries, that development framing will be a really good way to accelerate climate action. So you tell a policymaker, you do this, and a lot of people will have health benefits. Take this, reduce concrete, and you'll reduce heat-related impacts. And they like that. And then if that also reduces emissions, then it's a great win-win. So we're trying to find more of these solutions that improve well-being, that generate jobs, but also address climate. Whereas in the West, I think climate becomes a central framing. So you want to take climate action and you want to do other things. But I think for our context to get multiple wins is really, really a priority.
Right. Well, surprising heat waves all over the world show us that every city needs an emergency heat plan. Ahmedabad is rated as one of the hottest in Asia, with uncomfortable heat on 331 of 365 days. Talk to us about ideas for short-term resilience. What can cities, including in India, do?
I think first thing that cities need to do is to identify who is more vulnerable. It's not a general heat action plan, but really to look at people who are in these most precarious professions. So if I just walk outside my door downstairs in the street, I'm going to see vegetable vendors, fruit vendors, people who manually pull these freight carts. And there's I can almost think of 24 occupations where people spend more than 8 hours outdoors. And it's not just their own personal health, but it's also what they're selling. So it's an economic loss as well because of heat. And I think the top priority has to be to protect them, to identify them, first of all, and to find ways to protect them, to give them shelter. But also, how do you improve, for example, finance that goes to them, maybe what they're losing as daily wage? Like if these people, they earn on a day-to-day basis. So if I miss 2 days of work, it's really a big loss because I support my family and I just cannot afford, I don't have any savings. And so these are the people, I think the immediate short-term priority should be addressing the vulnerability of the populations. But a slightly medium-term would be, I would say, look at housing, because I feel like among all the initiatives, housing is really key. So many of these people, they live in slums or like one room. I wouldn't even call them houses. They're like really just shelters, basic shelters. And many of these have metal roofs. And these houses really heat up because the roof heats up in the afternoons. And we did a study a few years ago and we measured temperatures inside these houses and outside these houses. And we found in some cases that the temperature inside the house was higher than the outdoor temperature, which is really strange because it's almost like it's a matter of concern, because the outdoor temperature sometimes is 45 and the indoor temperature we measured was 48 degrees Celsius. That's almost like an inhuman way of survival. So are they surviving? Yes. Is there well-being? No. So I think we really need to fix informal housing and to just give people more dignity with housing and infrastructure. It's not about people like me, but it's about a section in the society who's really facing the worst of climate change and almost having contributed nothing to it. Like they almost have zero emissions. They don't even meet like basic decent standards of energy consumption. For example, they don't have electricity. They don't have as many appliances. They don't own motorized vehicles. So by a global average, their consumption or contribution to climate change is a fraction of the global average. So I feel like we're really not doing justice to these large populations around the world.
And frankly, I'm not sure long-term adaptation is possible if the world warms 3 degrees C or more. Cities of concrete and asphalt are like heat sinks. During heat waves, people cannot survive for long without electricity, although some manage to. What if the world warms faster than we can act, especially in democracies with slow bureaucracies?
I think all countries have slow bureaucracies, but that's just my own take on it. I definitely think that the future is concerning. One, because there's an uncertainty around future climate. We are assuming that climate changes in response to emissions as we have seen, but we know that that may not be true. And what if, like you say, that we release X amount of emissions and we expect, let's say, the global temperature to increase by some measure, but it's actually much more than that. So we are looking at huge biodiversity loss. We are seeing a world that we have not experienced in the near history. And we really don't know enough about that world. Typically, we call it an overshoot world. So what if you come back to 1.5, but you overshoot a threshold in the interim? And what does that overshoot mean? What does the world look like in that extreme scenario? There are limits to adaptation. It's not going to be easy. And therefore, we must just start now. The good news is that there's a lot of cities are also taking action. There is more increase in green cover in many parts of the world. Even in the developing countries, I'm seeing cities wanting to take action on enhancing urban forests as much as possible, right? But there is now greater awareness, and I mean, if I had to end with some hope, then I would say that let's not get buoyed down by how depressing the future looks, because that may just discourage people from taking action. And if we did this interview, maybe say 5 years from now, my responses would be very different. I think we would have definitely run out of time and carbon budget. But we are doing this now, and scientifically and practically, it is still possible to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And like, I would just urge all the people listening to this show that really it's not, let's put our day-to-day matters aside and really think how, because we are at a unique point in history. We will be looked at far into the history too as a population that just failed to take action, and that just gave our future generation a really bad world. And it is up to us to go beyond our individual interests and really see that there are people in the world who are far worse off than what we are. And we should really care. I'm sure a lot of people care, but sometimes we just forget because maybe I have a deadline at work, or my daughter has exams at school, or, you know, people have these pressing matters that they think are pressing on a day-to-day level. But I can tell you, looking at that future climate graphs and maps, that we really, really do need to ramp up action at every level.
Men still outnumber women in climate science, even though polls find women are more likely than men to believe in climate science. Manal, you co-authored a 2022 study called Survey of Gender Bias in the IPCC. What are the risks of underrepresenting and really not listening to women about climate change?
Yeah, we're not really listening to women, generally speaking, not just around climate. If you look at representation of women in parliaments, in leadership positions, in companies, in governments, it's not balanced. We don't have a lot of literature on it, but we do have enough literature to say that women make better choices with regard to climate. They consume lower energy, partly because in many parts of the world, women don't even travel because they don't have access to mobility. But generally speaking, because in many cases, women also influence household decisions about what food is brought in the house or how the house runs. And therefore, women have a better understanding of consumption. And involving more women in climate decisions is likely to lead to better outcomes. And it has been shown that in societies where women have a higher voice in the formation of the government, it leads to more balanced decisions. We do need to have more women. We need to have not just for representation, but also their voices heard and their opinions that are taken into consideration in policy making. So we have a long way to go, but we should raise these very important questions.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. From Ahmedabad University, we've been speaking with Associate Professor Manal Pathak. Find links to her recent papers and this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Manal, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What was once predicted only by models is now playing out in real time across the world. Extreme rains flood desert cities. Heat records are smashed daily on multiple continents. Professor Wolfgang Kramer has documented it all since the early 1990s. This IPCC author, with over 150 peer-reviewed papers, joins other scientists and academics calling on the public to become climate advocates and activists. Wolfgang was a longtime scientist at the Potsdam Institute. He is now director of research and professor of global ecology at the Mediterranean Institute for Marine and Terrestrial Biodiversity and Ecology, and that's located at Aix-Marseille Université. From France, Wolfgang Kramer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, as climate destabilizes the life support systems, it's pretty frightening. Are some places becoming too dangerous to live in?
That may be the case, that some places become too dangerous to live in, but that will not be the same for each and everyone in the population. So when we talk about dangerous places, then we mostly look at the fact that the poor are the ones that are worse hit by climate warming,